yeah, I want an XML tag to do this, but I want it to generate 5 related Bean definitions that all work together in a particular way. I don't want to go defining Beans one at a time. I just want to drop in this unit. So, for example, I want to build a third-party product, and I want users to be able to just configure it with validation, so having validation about the configuration choices that are available and producing whatever number of collaborating objects that is necessary for that scenario. So we can also, of course, ship tags out of the box to address common configuration tasks. So I think this is a good example of a feature that meets both of our goals of simplicity and power. We also get quite a lot of benefit out of switching to XML schema for this feature, because it means that we get far more sophisticated validation than we can get with DTD. By the way, Spring 2 obviously fully supports the existing DTD, so all your existing configurations will run just fine. It's just that there's a new option for using schema-based configuration. So there's complete interoperability. You can even build, if you want, you can build an application context through parsing multiple configuration files, some of which are in the new schema and some of which are in the existing DTD. The schema, by the way, looks exactly, if you use the schema without importing additional namespaces for extensions, it looks exactly like the DTD. So you already know the core of the schema. It's still based on the Beans element. The aim for this is that it provides additional choice. So in most cases where you're defining your own Beans, you will still use the Bean element as before, because it's a flexible generic configuration mechanism. And that's what you normally want, because you want to be able to tell a container, hey, you don't know anything about this class, but you know how to wire things together. So please wire that class together for me. So that is the most common choice for application code, but there's also the ability to have targeted problem-specific configuration. Think about it, for example, like JSP custom tags. If you want to do something over and over again, you want to abstract it. It's ideal for third parties developing Spring components. A good example of this will be ACG security, which is currently relatively complex to configure. The complexity in configuring ACG security is going to be absolutely slashed when it fully adopts Spring 2 style configuration. So let's look at some examples of what this looks like. The first example here, I hope, can people read that at the back? What does this do? Anyone want to volunteer what this Bean definition does? Yeah, it basically does a JNDI lookup and means that you've now got a data source that was probably a transactional data source that was exposed by your application server. So notice here that you've specified the class of, I've omitted the packaging, but Jindy Object Factory Bean, and you've specified the JNDI name. In Spring 2, this can be expressed like this, where you have a JNDI lookup tag. You still obviously need to specify the ID, but you provide the JNDI name as a required attribute. So, of course, now you get code completion because your XML tool can be aware that this is a mandatory property and there's a number of properties that are not required. So you can still get assistance on them, but you can very quickly see, before Spring even parses this, you can very quickly see in your tool what the required structure is. In this case, it's still producing one Bean definition. This is an example of out-of-the-box configuration. Another example, defining a properties object using properties factory Bean. Again, we can replace that by using the util properties tag, and now the location will automatically prompt us. Obviously, the benefits are even greater when you have things like ACG security, where you have multiple things that need to work together. Now you can provide a single tag that generates multiple Bean definitions. So it still generates the same Java metadata that Spring uses internally. Another rather new feature, this feature is new to Spring 2 RC1 is that there's a neat little shorthand for using attributes in some cases rather than sub-elements. So here we have a way of just populating a Java object. Spring doesn't know anything particular about my person object. We can now express this, if we want, using a special namespace, which allows the use of properties. So here you're not going to get validation for that, but on the other hand, it's very concise. So in a number of cases, it really significantly reduces the angle bracket count. Of course, there's a number of important pieces of Spring functionality that really benefit from this in a big way. One of the most important is transaction management. For example, if you've used Spring, the Spring transaction annotation, which was introduced, transactional was introduced in 1.2, there's about three magic bean definitions that you can put together which cause Spring to say, I'm going to scan every single class that I see for the existence of transactional annotations. If I find them, I'm just going to make them transactional without requiring any explicit proxy creation step. So that required about three bean definitions that you could reuse across different applications, but it was essentially boilerplate. In Spring 2.0, that is replaced by a single tag, TX annotation driven. And what this does is generate those bean definitions. So they have to combine in a particular way, and here we're benefiting from this ability to provide a higher level of abstraction. Configuration options out of the box, obviously around JNDI, proxying for over particular protocols. There's a new namespace to handle AOP, which makes a lot of things significantly easier to do than with generic configuration. There's also the opportunity to have new namespaces around particular platform functionality. So, for example, BEA are doing a WebLogic namespace, and some of the work that we've been doing with Oracle around SCA involves experimenting with an SCA namespace. So how do you write custom extensions? Well, I'm not going to go through this in detail, but I'm just going to walk through the three steps that are required so you can see just how easy it is. The first step is by far the most difficult step, and it doesn't directly involve Spring. So you need to start off by defining your XML schema. And this will, of course, be used to validate the element content. You need to use an appropriate tool for that. Do not try doing it by hand. Writing an XML schema by hand is really not something that any sane person wants to do. Step two involves implementing a class that's called a namespace handler. A namespace handler is a Spring 2 interface implementation that provides bean definition parsers for elements. So it will be called back now when Spring's configuration parsing encounters your tags. So when it encounters a new tag in your namespace, it says, well, I don't know about this. It's up to you to go and parse that. You can do this using a bean definition parser. You provide a bean definition parser that parses the element and adds the resulting bean definition or definitions to a bean definition registry, which holds Spring metadata. There's something that's been introduced called bean definition builder that's very handy for that as well, which makes it much easier than it was in the past to generate bean definitions. Thirdly, there's a file called spring.handlers in the meta-inf directory, and you can add this, as many of these as you want, in different with different class path routes, and they all get merged together. So you have to provide a mapping from the schema that you want people to import to your fully qualified handler class name. And once you do that, you have extended the power of Spring's configuration processing. So it's pretty straightforward to do. When you use it, you need to import the namespace, and then you can start using the tags in that namespace. The standard bean tags, of course, do not require being prefixed by any namespace. So they're in the default namespace. You only need to use the namespace prefix if you've imported some custom namespace. So what are the best practices around this? Well, it's not designed to be a replacement to the existing configuration mechanism. It is a complement to it. So the standard bean tags are still an excellent solution for most user-defined objects. However, you can use out-of-the-box tags that we provide and that you get from third parties. And if you, for example, want to build a very large application or build componentry that will be used across an organization, you can use this to provide neatly abstracted little components that people can drop in. Let's now look at the AOP enhancements. This is another of the major new features in Spring 2.0. Let's briefly recap why aspects are important. Dependency injection provides a very nice decoupling. So it hides the details of resource and collaborator discovery. It gets away from lookups, and it means that you get the ability to have your code configured differently in different environments without any knowledge of the fact that, say, JNDI or potentially even JMX or various client remoting protocols might be used underneath in terms of where collaborators come from. Aspects provide the same kind of benefit in concealing complexity and decoupling, but they do it around service invocation. So aspects are ideal for delivering infrastructure such as transaction management or remoting, and also they're very powerful for using performing many user-defined things, such as enforcement of rules and policies. So DI and aspects work together particularly well. They're both necessary to build a true POJO programming model, and it's natural to want to use them together. Of course, this is something that Spring has always done and which Spring brought to the mainstream. So what have we done in Spring 2.0 to evolve Spring AOP? There's a number of things that we've done. We've provided a namespace, a dedicated namespace for working with AOP. One of the challenges in using Spring AOP previously was that although it was quite easy to use programmatically, if you wanted to do more complex and advanced things, they were relatively hard to do in XML because the generic configuration didn't know about Spring AOP. We obviously didn't want to make the IOC container depend on the AOP framework because we want to keep Spring modular. But on the other hand, we had no way prior to Spring 2.0 of having AOP-specific configuration without changing the core DTD. So we would have had to have AOP tags and knowledge of the AOP classes in the processing. As you can see with the namespace approach, we have implemented an AOP namespace handler that handles an AOP namespace, and the core IOC container doesn't need to know anything about it. So that's one of the important things that made the AOP enhancements possible. Another is that we've integrated very closely with AspectJ. AspectJ is by far the most powerful AOP technology. AspectJ is really the de facto standard for full-featured AOP. It's very mature, very well documented, and it's the product of the definitive research on AOP. AspectJ, amongst other things, provides an extremely powerful point-cut expression language, which I will describe later. It also has a very elegant annotation-based syntax that was inherited from AspectWorks. One of the interesting things that happened in AOP last year was there was a merger between the AspectJ and the AspectWorks project. So basically, this was a very interesting thing from the point of view of any project that is interested in AOP, because what it meant was that there was a very clear winner in terms of the programming model for full-featured AOP. So originally you had the four products in the AOP space. You had Spring AOP, which was not the most powerful, it was certainly the most widely used, had AspectJ, you had AspectWorks, and you had JBoss AOP. So with the merger between AspectWorks and AspectJ, it was pretty clear that Aspect J was becoming the dominant player beside Spring AOP. So what we wanted to do is ensure that we could ensure that we integrate very nicely with that, and that we provide as many of the Aspect J capabilities and the Aspect J programming model as we can right within Spring's proxy-based runtime. One of the other things that we're doing in Spring 2.0 is for the first time we're actually shipping some Aspect J aspects to do things like make any object transactional regardless of whether it was instantiated by Spring, if it's annotated with a transactional annotation, and also to dependency inject any object regardless of whether it's created by Spring. So you don't, those are targeted at people who wish to use both Aspect J and Spring. So for people who are not using Aspect J at all, they're not going to get the benefit of those features, but it's entirely new functionality rather than functionality that you need to use Aspect J for. So we looked at the pros and cons of Spring AOP in the Spring 1 series, and we looked at how we could preserve the strengths while reducing the negatives. So obviously the biggest pro of Spring AOP is that it's a proxy-based model. This means that it has virtually zero cost of adoption. You don't need to change your class loading. You don't need to use a special compiler. You don't need to do any load time weaving. It just works. You just drop in the aspect definitions in your XML files, and it works in any environment. That's essentially the killer characteristic of Spring AOP that has made it so widely adopted. Of course, it's highly integrated with the Spring container as well. On the negatives, it had no real point-cut expression language. There was a simple kind of name-matching regular expression capability, but there was no true point-cut expression language. XML configuration could be verbose. And although Spring AOP was highly extensible, it was extensible essentially only in Java. So if you wanted to write a sophisticated matching rule, so a sophisticated point-cut, you needed to write Java code. The extensibility, by the way, was a very, very important capability to have underneath because we were able to implement the new features in 2.0 on top of the existing model. So we don't actually change the Spring AOP runtime at all. We just build another layer on top of it. So we wanted to build on the strengths and eliminate the weaknesses. It was vital to preserve the ease of adoption, but we wanted to take as many good things as we could from Aspect J. And we wanted to provide a comprehensive AOP roadmap that enables people to work with whatever level of AOP they're comfortable with. That might be none at all. It might be using out-of-the-box features like Spring Transaction Management and remoting and JMX that are actually implemented using AOP. It might be using an occasional aspect, or it might be embracing AOP in a more ambitious manner and, for example, doing architectural enforcement or auditing across a range of objects. So the solution was pretty clear. We wanted to be able to work with the good things about Aspect J, which was the definitive AOP solution. And fortunately, we were able to entice Adrian Collier, who's the lead of Aspect J, away from IBM, and he joined Interface 21 last October. He's now making a very, very significant contribution to Spring, as well as Aspect J, and his contribution is actually not merely around AOP. He's working on quite a lot of very interesting features for post-Spring 2.0. But obviously one of the things that he was most involved with was working with myself and Rob Harrop on the AOP integration between Spring AOP and Aspect J. So let's look at the benefits that flow from this. Why is it a good thing to do? Well, the question, if point cuts are the core of AOP, a point cut is a matching rule that says where should this behavior apply? So for example, imagine the concept of expressed in a requirement where a manager comes up to you and says, every operation that returns an account needs to be subject to a security check. That account is allowed to be seen by the user who's using the system. That is a requirement that clearly expresses a business intent. Wouldn't it be nice if we could take that requirement and actually express it in code? And the beauty of having a true point cut model is we can actually do that. We can write a point cut expression very easily that says every method that returns an account will be matched by this point cut expression. Obviously, it's the product of a lot of work over the last, it's probably close to 10 years now, and some interesting capabilities are the ability to have type-safe advice. So you get away from the D-typed characteristics of all interceptor models. There are, of course, significant benefits for AspectJ as well as Spring, because AspectJ is a language, not a framework. So AspectJ aspects, for people who are using AspectJ, benefit greatly from dependency injection and the features such as Spring provides. So, for example, writing a transaction aspect, which we've provided in Spring 2.0, writing the AspectJ point cut to fire that behavior is trivial. It's about 30 lines of code, but it's about 30 lines of code that builds on the Spring transaction abstraction. So Spring has a lot of abstractions that are very valuable to developers who are using AspectJ. But of course, it also means that there's a unification of the programming model and an incremental adoption path in terms of how people can use valuable features of the AspectJ programming model right in Spring, but also if they want, they can embrace the use of the AspectJ compiler. So this means that for end users, you get a lot of existing functionality coming from AspectJ. You get the ability to do things like dependency inject objects that weren't instantiated using Spring, and you can use the same knowledge in Spring and AspectJ. So essentially, you can, if you want to move towards greater use of AspectJ, you've already learnt key features of the programming model. You can use AspectJ point cut expressions in either Spring XML with the new AOP namespace. You can use it in the @AspectJ annotation style that came from AspectWorks, or you can use it programmatically in Java code. Why is this good? Well, as I mentioned, we had various wildcarding functionality in Spring AOP. That is just not enough, because wildcarding will enable you, for example, to match all methods on a particular class, or match methods that, for example, look like getters because their name starts with get, but it totally misses out the semantics of the language. It is simple pattern matching, string matching, which doesn't understand the language. The AspectJ approach is to view point cuts as first-class language constructs. And in fact, in the AspectJ language, which is an extension to Java, there is a keyword called point cut. So this literally is part of the language. So what does it mean to make something a first-class language construct? It means that you can compose things into expressions. So you have a massive potential for reuse. You can say, this point cut is only true when the following three point cuts are true. So you can reuse point cuts you designed earlier. And you can perform what's called argument binding, where you bind particular parameters, for example, or return types, as part of the point cut. Let's have a look at this in practice. Another benefit of this is that it's already well documented. If we'd invented our own point cut language, we would have had to document it from scratch, whereas in this case, there are many excellent books on AspectJ. As I mentioned, AOP is about point cuts. If we don't have the notion of point cut matching, we have interception rather than AOP, and there are a number of problems with that. One is that it's less efficient. So, for example, remember what I mentioned about methods that return account objects. We have to perform a test in the body of our interceptor, if it's invoked for every method, to say, do you return an account object? It also tends to be quite error-prone. A good example of that is with the interception model in EJB3. On page 25 of the simplified programming model spec, there's a piece of code that if a new method without arguments was added to the business interface, would throw an array index out of bounds exception, because it's making assumptions about the number of arguments. And when you have no point cut concept at all, that kind of fragility is absolutely inevitable, because essentially you have to write defensive code everywhere you implement an interceptor. Spring always had point cuts, but as I mentioned, they largely needed to be expressed in Java. So let's look at how we can do this using the AspectJ features. So here we have an example of the capability of using an arbitrary piece of Java code and making it an aspect. So here it's not a tremendously interesting piece of code. It is going to count invocations of getters and setters. So we're going to use these two methods in response to various events in our program execution. We can do this using the new Spring AOP namespace. So here what we're saying is that the bean with this name, and of course it's expressed elsewhere as a Spring bean, is an aspect. Before the execution of any getter, invoke the before getter method. So I invoke this method. After the returning of any setter, invoke the after setter method. So here we have examples of the AspectJ point cut language. Remember what I said about the issues around simple pattern matching. This is much more than simple pattern matching because it is aware of language constructs. So for example, imagine that I thought a getter was anything where a method name started with get. That is not the definition of a getter. A getter has no arguments. A getter is public. And a getter returns something other than void. So in other words, there are plenty of ways that if I use a very simple approach like that, either in Java code in my interceptor to do filtering, or in a simple regular expression style matching, there are many ways that my code could ultimately break in ways that I would not expect. Whereas this is much more robust. This string in the AspectJ expression, point cut expression language, says the execution of any public method that returns something other than void, the name begins with get, and the empty brackets here means that it has no arguments. So anything that is really not a getter, because, for example, it has arguments, will be excluded by this. Similarly, we have a point cut expression here that refers to a setter saying it has a single argument, its name begins with set, it's public, and it's void. We can also use the same point cut expression style in what's called the AspectJ annotation style. This previous style, by the way, will work even if you're not using Java 5. So you could actually use this if you're using certainly 1.4. I haven't tried this particular feature in 1.3. I believe it would probably work in 1.3, but it certainly works in 1.4. So this is a new style that was introduced originally from AspectWorks into AspectJ 5. So here we have annotations that mark this class as being an aspect. These annotations are not Spring annotations, they're AspectJ annotations. And we have the ability to annotate methods relating to advice. So here we're saying this method should execute before this point cut is reached. So before we have the execution of any method on an account object, you will get this piece of code executing. After, at the bottom there, after the returning of any object, any method that involved a call to an account object, we'll do this logging step. So it's not a tremendously interesting aspect, but as you can see, it's really quite elegant because it correctly achieves the primary goal of AOP. The primary goal of AOP is to take code that would otherwise be scattered across your code base and to modularize it. So this could be, I should actually really change this example to refer to what I previously mentioned about security checks on accounts. I could write a piece of code that is a single code module that relates to what my manager said. I want a certain kind of auditing for security purposes on whether an account is visible. I could write a single piece of code and drop that into my system. I don't need to go and annotate in multiple places in my code. I don't need to change XML in multiple places. All I need to do is drop in this piece of Java code. And of course, it's exactly the same point cut language. This is pure AspectJ syntax. What we've added is the ability to run that right in Spring with a proxy-based approach. In case you're wondering, the point cut parsing is actually done using AspectJ. One of the changes in AspectJ 5, which was motivated by Spring, is that the point cut expression parser is being split out by the compiler. So it will be parsed and it will achieve the same result as if you actually compiled that with AspectJ. How do you enable it? Well, it's not that difficult because of the way in which this feature sits with the new configuration extensions. All you need to do is add a single tag, AOP AspectJ AutoProxy. Now, as soon as you add one or more bean definitions that are actually AspectJ aspects being annotated in this way, that every object in the Spring context will automatically be weaved if it needs to. So here we have two beans. We have an account object, which is obviously going to be eligible to being affected by that aspect, and we have defined the aspect itself. Because we configured this, Spring has said, you're an aspect. I'm going to apply you to every other object that I find that may be affected by you. Of course, it means as well that you can dependency inject your aspects. So, I mean, as I mentioned, aspects are just like any other classes in that they can benefit quite a lot from being dependency injected. I mentioned the concept of argument binding. This is a more complex example, but one thing that you'll note is really quite interesting is that here we're able to bind one of the arguments in the point cut, which is the target of the invocation. We're able to bind it right to one of the parameters. So we don't have to worry about indexing into an argument array, seeing whether the length of the argument array is 1 and that the first element of the argument array, etc., is of the correct type. We can actually use binding right from the point cut, which is optimally efficient, and it also means that you can never get things like class cast exceptions. You can never get array index out of bounds. It's very, very robust. AOP, hopefully you will agree, is much more than interception. Interception is actually just an implementation strategy, and it is not a complete conceptual model of AOP. We think that the correct conceptual model for AOP is AspectJ. So therefore, it makes sense for us to deliver as much of the AspectJ capabilities as we can in our proxy-based infrastructure. Spring 2 is, of course, wholly backwards compatible with respect to AOP. So all your existing aspects that you may have written with Spring, like method interceptor, etc., all that still works and will continue to work because it's all still underneath anyway to power the AspectJ integration. The really interesting benefit of this is that it's about unification. So it brings the same programming model to AOP regardless of whether you're using a proxy-based, compiler-based, or load-time weaving approach. So we believe that the choice of implementation strategy should not affect the programming model. Of course, this means that you have quite a lot of benefits in how you might want to move forward. In some cases, you might think, wow, we're really getting a lot of benefit out of this. We want to actually experiment to see whether using AspectJ would be beneficial. So now, of course, you're enabled to use the same programming model. It's a good example, I think, of how there's no conflict between simplicity and power. So, for example, if I were to write a code module that did that kind of account auditing, with this approach, it will be far simpler than the alternatives because it won't need those fragile kind of checks that you would otherwise get with a pure interception approach. It will be a single code module. There won't be a need to change multiple XML files or potentially put annotations in multiple places. It is actually the simplest way to do many things, not just the most powerful way. We think this is really quite an innovative feature in Spring 2.0, the way in which we've been able to achieve a unification of the AOP programming model. One interesting thing that we're seeing is that quite a lot of the AOP community are now really looking to this as one of the most interesting developments in AOP in the last, well, probably since the AspectJ and AspectWorks merger. So let's now use the remaining 10 minutes to look at some of the other features in Spring 2.0. There's the ability to add new custom scopes to the Spring IOC container. If you're using Spring, you're probably familiar with the notion of a singleton and a prototype. A singleton is an object that lives for the lifetime of the owning container. A prototype object is an object where you manage its life cycle. So the container creates it for you, but you're responsible for managing it thereafter. In Spring 2.0, we provide a transparent scoping option which can work with per request and per session scoping backed by the HTTP session and request, but also have support for arbitrary scope. So, for example, you could use a clustered caching product, like, for example, a Coherence distributed cache, or also products from other vendors like Terracotta, Gigaspaces, various other vendors. There's all of those could be plugged in transparently behind your bean definitions with a named scope. Let's look at an example of using this. Here we have a Spring MVC controller that has the injection of an account object, and we're able to simply now work with the account object, and it will be transparently the correct one from the user's HTTP session. The way in which we, I don't think I've got an example of configuring this in the XML, basically your account bean definition just specifies a scope as being request scope. So let's look at the implications for backward compatibility. There's quite a lot of new features overall. What breaks as a result of this? So if you've got an existing Spring application and you decide you want to upgrade to Spring 2.0, either now or when it goes final at the beginning of July, what is going to break if you look at everything across your application architecture? Well, there's rather good news on this, because this is what is going to break. Absolutely nothing will break. Spring 2 is fully backward compatible. And we put a lot of emphasis on this, because if you want to have a credible technology in the enterprise space, you cannot assume that every time you do a new release, the world changes around you. The enterprise space is about things that evolve at a rate that's determined by business needs, rather than at a rate that's determined by your fancy framework or container. So we've put a lot of effort into keeping Spring backward compatible, and I think this proves the benefit of a POJO-based programming model, that we're able to do fairly substantial enhancements and yet preserve backward compatibility. Do you need Java 5? No, as I mentioned, it runs on 1.3 and above, but you will get an increasing number of new features if you're able to use Java 5. And this, in fact, is not new in Spring 2. There's a load more features that are available for Java 5 users in Spring 2. But on the other hand, we've actually steadily been adding Java 5-specific features since 1.2. So, for example, we've had a transaction annotation and various JMX-related annotations that have been available for probably something like a year now. And, of course, it continues to run on all leading application servers and web containers and outside any other container. Another interesting new feature that's really quite recent in Spring 2.0, and in fact is one of the major reasons that we've had to put the release back, because we were originally hoping to release early summer, is integration with the Java Persistence API. Hopefully, some of you have caught Mike Keith and Patrick Linsky's talk on this. It's essentially a standard for real-world OR mapping, and it's usable in either an EJB environment or externally. Why should you care about this? Well, I think one really interesting thing is that because OR mapping is very well understood, and in fact there's something like, in the case of TopLink, there's probably, I think, about 13 years of experience that's gone into it. And, of course, there was a whole lot of research back in the days of Smalltalk into OR mapping. Because OI mapping is so well understood, it is amenable to standardization. And so this means that you have the ability to have competing implementations. The surface area of an OR mapping product is actually pretty small as well. So if you look, for example, at the Entity Manager Factory and the Entity Manager in the Java Persistence API, they're not tremendously big interfaces. Another reason that it's very important to have choice is that the choice is now actually open source. There are, right now, there are two full-featured open source OR mapping tools. There's Hibernate and there's also TopLink. The core of TopLink is now completely open source with no kind of crippling or restrictions. TopLink is also actually the reference implementation for EJB3 persistence. BEA are in the process of open sourcing the former Solarmetric Kodo product as OpenJPA. So this means that there will be three competing open source OR mapping solutions. And it really makes sense to move to the API that gives you the choice to evaluate all of those and choose the one that performs best for your capability, your environment. They have very different architectures internally. So the performance characteristics in particular vary quite a lot. And it's very beneficial for users to be able to choose which one is most appropriate for their scenario. We've put a major investment in Spring 2.0 into integration with JPA. Obviously, data access integration has been one of the key features that Spring has already provided. And we provide everything for JPA that we provide with all the other supported data access APIs. For example, unified programming model for an EE and SE environment, ease of testing without deploying to an application server or any other container, you can very quickly and easily run tests that actually use a staging database for persistence. We go far beyond a mere API level integration. So we provide a full JPA container. If you look at the Java Persistence API, there's an interface called a persistence provider, and there are two ways in which it can create an entity manager factory. One is that it can create it using the Java SE contract, which basically means that it's reliant on having a Java agent. Another is that it can provide a complete container. It can exist in a container environment where the container is parsing things like the persistence XML file and providing a runtime that's capable of doing the bytecode instrumentation that a persistence provider needs. So we provide the full JPA container as part of Spring 2.0. This provides a full JPA feature set in any environment, including a test case. It supports the bytecode instrumentation, which is necessary. And our bytecode instrumentation, which is now available in a portable fashion, we can use in Spring 2.1 and the future to do some very interesting things with, for example, out-of-the-box AspectJ aspects. We provide support for the at persistence context and at persistence unit injection annotations that are part of the JPA spec. We provide things like the automatic enlistment of an entity manager in a current transaction and support for what's called an extended entity manager. So we provide a complete container. This is the result of not only a lot of hard work within the Spring team, but also we've benefited from quite a bit of input from both Oracle and BEA into this. In fact, Mike Keith has been particularly helpful in terms of giving us advice on doing this. So hopefully you've understood now some of the aims of Spring 2.0, how we're trying to build on the existing strength of Spring and make things both simpler and more powerful. You've looked at some of the significant new features like the configuration extensibility and the shipping of custom out-of-the-box tags. You've seen the significant improvements in Spring AOP. You've seen that there are quite a range of other enhancements, and I mean the list is in fact longer than this, which I didn't have time to talk about in detail. So we feel that it very strongly deserves the title of a major release. To finish off with, one thing that I would like to say is that we think that Spring 2 is a very major step. But we actually also see it as the base for moving forward with quite a lot of further innovations. So I think you'll see for the rest of the year some more significant innovations with respect to configuration, with respect to modularization and integration between Spring and OSGI, various interesting things in the web space. So we're very proud of what we've achieved with Spring 2.0, and we hope you find it beneficial as well. But we certainly don't see it as an end in itself. We see it as a solid platform to do further significant innovation moving forward. Thank you.